Welcome, and thank you for joining us in the Restorative Lens podcast, where we bring together voices in the restorative justice community to share insight, practices, and perspective.
Each series of the Restorative Lens will be focusing on different topics within the field of restorative justice and give a space to hear from those who are most directly impacted or involved in the work.
The Restorative Lens is supported under the National Center on Restorative Justice, and we are your hosts, Alana Ojibwe
and Demoite Wesley. We're so excited to share this second series where we speak with facilitators from a recent National Center co-sponsored event. This event on equitable systems design for restorative justice provided an opportunity for participants to engage around key themes such as procedural fairness, access bias and decision-making, cultural competency, research and evaluation, policy and advocacy, and program implementation and fidelity.
The conversations in this series of the Restorative Lens create the opportunity to share some of these insights, reflections, and continued questions that came out of this event, as well as explore opportunities to address disparities within restorative justice implementation moving forward.
Thank you again for tuning in to the Restorative Lens, and we hope you enjoy listening.
This project is supported by grants awarded by the Bureau of Justice Assistance. The Bureau of Justice Assistance is a component of the U.S. Department of Justice's Office of Justice Programs.
Points of view, images, or opinions in this podcast are those of the hosts and guests and do not necessarily represent the official position or policies of the U.S. Department of Justice. Welcome to this episode of the Restorative Lens. Thank you, Monica and Anne, for joining us. I think it's a good idea to do some introductions, go around. So let's start with our guests, Anne or Monica, whoever would like to go first. Just share a little bit about yourself. Who are you? What's your name? Where are you based? And could you give us like a snapshot of where you are or where you call home? So what are some things that you would see, hear, smell, taste, where you're from?
I like it. Okay, that was a long list, Monday. So if I forget something, you just remind me, okay?
Of course.
So this is Anne Hobbs, and I am based in Nebraska right now. I'm originally from Alaska, so I always have this kind of yearning for mountains and water that doesn't always get fulfilled here. But one thing I love about Nebraska, people will think I'm crazy, but it is the steamy weather, like the really humid weather brings out intense smells. And I just love it in the summer. There's like flowers and then there's, you know, bad smells, good smells. So it's kind of a mixture of things. So I am the director of the Juvenile Justice Institute, and I really dig in and research things that are around the juvenile world. So that's a little bit about me.
Yes. Hi, everyone. I'm Monica Miles Steffens. I am the assistant director at the Juvenile Justice Institute, and our institute is housed in the School of Criminology and Criminal Justice at the University of Nebraska, Omaha. Anne and I have worked together for a really long time, not at the institute, but across our careers in the juvenile justice space in Nebraska. So that's been fun to be here. I've been at the institute for about 2.5 years now. I'm born and raised in Nebraska, in a small town in far western Nebraska. Nebraska's big geographically, but small people-wise. I think it takes about 8 hours to drive across the state. But there's about 1.9 million people all told in Nebraska. So that gives you a little context. We're in Lincoln. That's the capital. Anne's right, like summertime in Nebraska is great. The big thing at our house is we love to garden, and sweet corn is a big staple during the summer, things to eat. Lots of just fun being outside time.
So. Yeah.
So before we go into kind of more specifically about some of the things that emerged out of conversation at the Institute a couple months ago, we just wanted to back up a little bit and hear more, if you could sort of briefly describe your journey to and through the restorative justice world and how that experience intersects with this topic of research and evaluation.
You bet. Monica, is it okay if I'll jump in?
Yeah, jump in.
Yeah. So I feel like it's been a really long and winding journey for me. So I started my professional career as an attorney, not necessarily a juvenile attorney, but I was handling some juvenile cases when I first came across restorative justice, and it was through a diversion program. We had youth coming and going, and one day we had a case that really just opened my eyes to how effective the restorative justice process can be. And I'm happy to get into the weeds and describe it, and you know, but it was so moving that I always kind of go back to that point. So that was literally 27 years ago. So since then, I've done, you know, gone back and forth between research projects. And the question that people are always asking is, you know, how can we be effective? How can we be more effective? And I tell you, I always go back to that case because it was so moving and effective to see people truly connect. And it was a youth who had committed a burglary against a victim, and their relationship and how it blossomed really shaped my viewpoint on restorative practices and restorative justice, but also my career. Like, it's really come full circle, and I hope to spend the rest of my years doing restorative practice. So, yeah.
Yeah, I would say similar for me too. Probably not as far back as Anne.
Pretty soon, I'm not as old as you are. Right. I got that.
You're more experienced. So prior to coming to the Institute, I worked in our administrative office of the courts and probation, working to implement programs for youth on probation statewide. And I was there for quite a while, and before that, even in the space to try to find programs that work for kids in juvenile justice. And so I would hear about restorative justice things and was trying to kind of wrap my brain around it. And then Anne and I had, this is a whole nother story too, but Anne and I had the amazing opportunity to end up in Singapore in 2018 at a international restorative justice conference. That just really kind of, that was like the pivotal point that said, yeah, this is the way we need to be doing business, right? This isn't just a program, it's a philosophy, it's a way of being. And this is the direction we should be moving. And then, and a couple of years later, I actually had the opportunity where I got to experience it firsthand. My son was in middle school and experienced an assault at school. And so we ended up going through the process, partially because I knew how impactful it could be, both for him to have that closure and also for the person who committed the offense, to be able to try to repair some of that harm. And it was really impactful, and it went exactly how we had hoped, and it was really good. So then that also made me, I wanted to start doing that. So I've also become a practitioner as well. And so I help facilitate restorative conferences at our local mediation center in Nebraska, here in Lincoln. And a lot of those come through the schools, through probation and diversion. So it's been a great opportunity to just also learn the skill as well. I think it helps being able to explain to people how impactful it can be. So,
yeah, that's beautiful. Thank you both for sharing that experience and what brought you to this world of restorative justice. You both brought up like so many interesting points that I hope we'll get to touch on in the conversation around what does effectiveness even look like when it comes to restorative justice programs? How do we evaluate for effectiveness, success? What does that mean? But yeah, I'm also curious for each of you, you know, we're here to talk about research and evaluation, right? And Monica, you mentioned sort of being a practitioner and you starting out as an attorney. How does that bring you to sort of thinking about research as it relates to restorative justice?
Well, that's funny because I had to laugh when they asked me to help facilitate this session at the Institute because I'm not a researcher. That's Anne's department. So, but I think it's really important, right? As practitioners, as we implement restorative practices and restorative justice, people want to know why, right? So the research and the evaluation really helps establish the why we know it works, why we know when we implement things, the way in which to implement based on the research. So I think that's the lens that's really helpful to me.
And I would add to that I think being a practitioner really helps me be a grounded researcher. So I believe so passionately that research has to be accessible and practical, right? Like if I tell Western Nebraska or a really small town, you have to implement this evidence-based high cost program, it's totally a miss, right? I don't need to even evaluate to know that. But I think that it's just been hugely beneficial to be a practitioner first and to look at like, how do we really implement the research? There's great research being done in universities and a ton now around restorative practices, more than ever, right? But getting that translated into practice that's really what I'm most passionate about, because that's how we're going to change. I mean, not just our juvenile system, but our adult system, right? Like these kids, when we handle these cases poorly, they end up filtered into our adult system. And it's heartbreaking because Monica and I have both had a front row seat over the last, dozen years to see that happen. So it's really about changing and reforming our system through restorative lens. And I love that. Like, I can't wait to come to work every day. So goofy.
Not goofy. I agree with you. I actually had a quick follow-up question to that, if that's okay. That we're already going off the plan. But I wanted to ask about, I do think there's a real strength to coming to this, thinking about this lens of research, both as an advocate, as a practitioner, like bringing those different lenses, I think really is critical to understanding how to write or how to think about the kinds of questions that are most relevant to those impacted, to those practitioners most involved in this work. So I'm curious to hear a little bit more just sort of in your framing and sort of like coming into the Institute, how you think that lens of whether it was as a practitioner, as an attorney, as a, like how did that lens give you sort of, are there different considerations to think about specifically within restorative justice in that intersection of research and how challenging this idea of evaluation is in this field in particular? Like, how did that different lens and background inform this topic coming into the Institute around equitable systems design?
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I'll jump in, and then Monica, I think you'll have a ton to add. But I think when you come at, when you're looking at something, whether or not something's effective, and you come at it from a practitioner lens, it feels like you're coming alongside people. Versus when I come in as a researcher, it feels like I'm coming in top down and it's more judgmental. And I'll give you just a practical example. I could be meeting with a program and saying, okay, here's some initial thoughts I have in evaluating whether or not this program is effective. And they may say, and you're totally wrong. Like, looking at recidivism is too far down the road. We need to be measuring, did the quality of relationship happen? Is the victim less afraid? Were they satisfied with this process? Do they respect our systems more? Like, there's all these intermediate things that happen that I think as a practitioner, when you're listening to the people who are doing the work, and they know, right? The people doing the work, they know, they do this every day. So I think listening and respecting that opinion is so powerful that it's a huge benefit to be alongside people instead of top down. Mm-hmm. So, and Monica, you can probably speak more to that because, yeah.
No, that's really good. That's a big question. So I think it's something we're grappling, like everybody's grappling with, right? Like this idea of equitable systems and why there continues to be overrepresentation and sometimes a unwillingness to recognize, right? Some of the reasons why everybody wants like the quick fix, the right answer. Give me the right program, right? And I worry about that a little bit with restorative justice, people seeing it as a program, right? Like, here, if we just implement this, we're going to we're going to change the dynamics, which in some cases, like the research is showing, it can. But people have to understand it's not just a program you drop in to fix a systemic problem. You have to buy into the whole philosophy of it to change the system.
Mm-hmm. I think what it's done well, though, and Monica, I think we have a program that's just opening in Douglas County. I really think it's going to impact the disparity we see in our system when restorative practices are done well. The human is treated with dignity. And I think that's why right now we see such inequalities, is we're not treating certain groups with dignity. Mm-hmm. So I hope, like, if it's done well, we're right at that point where we're seeing this really catch on fire here in Nebraska, I think. Mm-hmm. So I'm hoping that it's going to really move the needle on some of the disproportionate patterns we've seen, but we'll have to see.
Yeah. And you both in your answers sort of spoke to this idea, but I'm curious to sort of get into what was happening. What was the conversation in the room at the Institute, right? Mm-hmm. What were some of the things that came up in terms of the key issues that people are identifying in the restorative justice world as it relates to research and evaluation, and especially as it relates to this idea of building equitable systems where, like you said, and maybe there aren't those overrepresentations of certain groups, certain folks of color, folks of certain socioeconomic classes. What were folks bringing up as sort of key issues in the work right now?
Yeah, we talked a lot about, just people can get caught up in, you know, is this restorative practice? Is this restorative justice? Is it a program? Like, and I really, I think we landed in the room. That's where I'm reading the notes is, I think we need to stop getting real stuck on that, because just like things, concepts like recidivism, you can measure things lots of different ways. And it's okay. It's okay to say, well, in this article or in this instance, I looked at a restorative justice program that does a really good job of working with victims, say, for example, or doing circles with kids in school. So I think when we define what the intervention is, it's fine to not have one uniform approach. This discussion came up again in Vermont, as Alana knows. So I think we need to kind of move off, like if we spend too much time spinning our wheels, we don't really ever make progress. And I've seen that a ton in my work around racial equity. I have gone to so many meetings where they want to argue about whether or not the data is good, instead of like, let's implement something that we know is effective and then watch how that cycle works, right? We can make changes as things go. So we did spend a lot of time talking about the definition and kind of what fits into restorative justice. Is that what you were thinking, Monica?
Yeah, that I think the one thing I'd add is the other thing that came up in Nebraska's, one of the things Anne and I ironically have learned in the last year and a half is that Nebraska has like the second highest number of statutes around restorative justice in the country, second to Colorado, which in some ways, as we've started diving into this, has been helpful, right? To embed it in statute, talking about systems, to embed it and to kind of give power to implementing restorative justice. But then, as we know, what happens with legislation is things kind of start getting jumbled together. And as that goes in one piece of the statute, it impacts the other piece of the statute and different people, over the course of time. And so we kind of struggle a little bit to quantify then how do we measure it if we're measuring according to statute and what the statute says, and how do we implement with fidelity based on what the statute says when maybe definitions don't necessarily line up. And then sometimes it can kind of limit implementation as well, depending on what statute says. So there's pros and cons to that piece too, in terms of equitable systems and definitions.
And I was going to add something heretical. Heretical, is that the word? As an attorney, like, I think the fact that we have more laws on the books, I don't know that that's been totally helpful. Like, when you implement with passion, sometimes it's not because of a law told you to do something. When you're equitable because you really believe in it, that's, I think, the true spirit of restorative justice, right? Like, I really admire your human dignity versus the law told me to do something. But like I said, as an attorney, I probably shouldn't have said that out loud, but.
Yeah, or not even statutes, but local policies and practices, right? So whereas we might, like in Lincoln, where I'm affiliated with the center, like we have a program that is the one that my son went through. It was great, but that young person had to go to diversion first based on local practices, when in fact it would probably have been an even better outcome, and for the youth not even having to get system involved to go through the program, but to be able to offer that in the school setting. So, but because we've kind of fit it into these current system processes, I think that's where the tension comes around those, again, that system design, right? How can we get it so far upstream that people don't have to be even involved in justice in order to benefit from restorative work? So let's see, I'm looking at our themes. Another one was kind of just in terms of evaluation, the qualitative versus quantitative and how to measure. One of the things that keeps popping up in our space is, and we keep getting asked by professionals, is what's the cost benefit of restorative justice? And how do we even wrap our heads around starting to measure that, quantify that? That's a really, really hard one.
How do you measure feeling safer in your neighborhood or feeling better about the kids in the school down the street, right? Like, it's tough to measure those concepts.
Yeah.
And to that point, if I could ask, like, how do you as researchers, research practitioners determine, like, yeah, we're going the numbers route. We're going to be accountable to the numbers versus we're going to be accountable to, like you said, Anne, how do people feel qualitatively? How do they feel safer? Do they feel safer in their neighborhood? How do you make that determination of, like, this is what our research is going to focus on?
So it's exciting because you can do, first of all, I think you should always do both. You should do mixed methodology whenever possible. But even around the question of relationship, or how do I think about, like, do I have a punitive approach to working with youth? You can measure those in numbers and then also get statements. And then they either contradict each other or support each other. So one of the things we're really at the start of doing is measuring individual system players' perspectives. Gosh, that's a lot of words. But how do individuals look at restorative practices? And we've done this in Lancaster County with, like, the schools, the prosecutors. And so we're starting to do this, like, at a systems level. What do your words say? But then also you can measure things like, do you think a kid should go to the county attorney's office, or should he be able to sit down informally at the school and resolve problems? And so as we measure those, we can then also then do a post measurement and see if they change. And we can take statements from people and see, you know, do your words line up with the numbers that we captured? So research is fun. Like, you can do it 85 different ways. It's like cooking.
Let's see. Another theme that came up in our session was kind of just funding requirements. Like, we're starting to see so much more funding become available for restorative justice, which is really exciting. But with that, a lot of times comes mandates for evaluation, and sometimes mandates that maybe don't line up with, like Anne was just saying, right? Like, you can measure things so many different ways, and sometimes the best way to measure something for a program may not be the way a funder wants it to be measured, or maybe isn't practical, or those kinds of things. So that was something that we discussed. And then kind of also tagging on what Anne said, which is exciting, is just that idea of getting people on board with a restorative mindset and culture, that it's really not just a program. And I think we see that a lot. I got contacted today from a center who said, we're giving a presentation to attorneys, like, how do we message this in a way to just move the dial on some of that embedded punitive mindset, and not saying that all attorneys are punitive, but in general, that's the way our system is set up, right? Is to be that adversarial kind of punitive system. And so how do we, when we're trying to fit in those restorative practices, it just isn't comfortable. It runs contrary to what our systems are used to. Go ahead, Anne.
Oh, I was just going to say, and it's not just punitive, like not just county attorneys, because I've worked with defense attorneys who were taking a protective stance, right? And they're like, I'm not going to let my client go talk openly about what happened. So I think it's really the adversarial system that makes restorative practices so difficult in this country, is when we set it up as one side against the other, it's hard to bring everybody together in a circle and then to talk openly about what went wrong, what problem happened. But I think, and I've seen this done in really punitive countries, and I think this can be done, right? Like, we just really all have to keep pushing it forward. So,
well, I think one of the other things we talked about is how do we use that, take that research and put it in a way that's practical and useful for practitioners, right? To get them on board. I mean, we've seen this in implementing lots of different kinds of evidence-based practices. There's people who are like, yes, that's the research. Great, let's go with it. And other people are like, I don't care what the research says. This is what I see day to day in front of me on the ground. And I don't see how this study is going to help me really, make a difference, right? So how do we package that information in ways that is helpful to people and helps them see through a different lens?
Yeah.
I was just going to ask, related to that I'm thinking somewhere between like collaborative and reciprocal is what I'm trying to get at, and thinking about like this intersection between research and practice, and like, what were there aspects of the conversation that came up around this, or that you've seen really stand out in your work in terms of, I was just really thinking about what you were just talking about, Monica, in terms of like, who is this for? Who is this serving? And if it's not coming directly from, or at least in collaboration with communities who are really front and center within this work, sort of what is the service of the research in the field going towards? Is it sort of a one-way street to inform policy, which is then still, like you were describing, if it's so disconnected from practice and from impacted communities, then you see the same kind of detrimental impacts and disparities in our system designs that we're trying to work against. And so I guess I'm just wondering, like, what does a more reciprocal model of community involved research look like that you've seen or maybe could imagine looking like, so that it doesn't feel so detached or disconnected or at worst extractive?
Yeah. I think we should see the needle move more quickly. So I'll just use a practical example of right now in Nebraska, we're starting a restorative justice research group where we come alongside practitioners. And I think, the very first conversation has to be, if we're committed to changing our typical or traditional system, next quarter, things should look differently. And I think sometimes from research, maybe because there's a delay, we wait years to see results. And I think we have to get away from that model and say, if I'm treating you well today, Alana, tomorrow, our relationship will be closer, or later today, right? Like, so I think moving our timeframes so they're more quickly, like things are happening more quickly. So a very practical example is often in our diversion programs, we see that certain populations don't engage. It might be the parents are working at a certain time, or they didn't get the letter, or it's not in the right language. And that can't wait till next year. We can't do an evaluation and wait till next year, because by that time the kid's in court and on probation. So we need to see in our research groups, we need to see movement within the next month. And that sounds really ambitious, but that's really what it's got to look like. And so if we're not serving a certain population well, by next month, we should see that improve. So that's kind of, like I said, ambitious, but we can't wait for these long-term results. That's not working for us. Yep.
Yeah. And I think equipping the people that we're coming alongside, right? So we are our state office of dispute resolution was one of seven grantees from around the country that got a systems reform grant from OJJDP. And so we're about, and that's to expand restorative justice models across the state. And so JJI's, and one of our grad students is the evaluator. But then it's like how that we've really tried to incorporate them into the process and the discussion around what variables do we measure and in the system that they're using to capture data, and not trying to make it so cumbersome for them to collect data just for research purposes, because then that creates resentment, right? So how do we take the information that they already gather and use it in a meaningful way, so that then it kind of helps them buy in to be like, oh, they're not here just to collect data for the sake of collecting data, right? So just really that partnership, like you were saying, Alana, of those conversations of what can work for them, what can work for us, and then and giving them information back that empowers them to be able to have conversations and use the information with these discussions with stakeholders and things like that. I think it just, it's one conversation and one group at a time.
Yeah. To follow up on like those ideas of like collaboration and reciprocal relationships, how do you, and you sort of spoke to this of like who does and does not engage. Is there a place for researchers and research practitioners to open up the space and allow more people to come to the table and have a role in program implementation, but also research and evaluation when we think about equity, right? And what does that require? What does it look like to actually invite more people? What is needed there to invite more people to this conversation and to diversify the voices that are being heard in restorative justice, but also research and evaluation of restorative mm-hmm. justice programs?
I love this question because we're just submitting a grant this week, and we're asking parents and families to weigh in and talk to us about the particular problem we're addressing is attendance at school, right? So we, instead of just going to the literature and going to the stacks, we're actually asking families, like, what does this look like for you post-COVID? What are the obstacles? What are the obstacles in a rural place? What are the obstacles in, South Omaha or North Omaha? Because I think it's surprising when you really listen to what families tell us. I'm totally surprised sometimes because it's not been in the research. But I think there's an ethical responsibility then, right? Like if a family tells me something, I feel like, and that's where I always struggle. And if I'm being real transparent, like I feel like families will tell me things, but can I get the system to meet that need? Because sometimes they're just such real needs in our communities. And as researchers, like if we just document them in an article, that feels like a really inappropriate response to human need. So I worry sometimes that our system, I don't know if I'll be able to get the system alongside me to implement a change. Again, a practical example is if we need diversion officers to meet on Saturday mornings because parents are working nonstop, or that window of time where they can meet, just being flexible. We learned through COVID, we can use Zoom, we can do this, right? But it's easy to say that from as an outsider. So I really need to work closer with practitioners to come up with creative solutions, I think, to meeting the human need, whatever it is.
Yeah, I just want to comment quickly that I think what's beautiful about what you share, Anne, is like it's form meeting function. In the restorative justice world, we talk a lot about needs, right? Needs, obligations. And so to think about how does that also show up when we're talking about doing research and evaluation, how are we also thinking about meeting needs? I think that is a beautiful example of form meeting function.
Yeah. I have to say, in Nebraska, we have a lot of communities that when we say your families really need this, we've seen some communities really step up. Mm. So I think that's what makes it possible. Like we're in one of those unique places where we're big enough to be doing some of this research, but also small enough to still be pretty receptive to other people's needs. So, and I think that has to do with population size sometimes, but yeah.
I'm wondering if either of you had any examples from the conversation that emerged out of sort of next steps, or what examples maybe looked like of, I don't know that solutions are, is the right term, because I think it's gonna, it's to be equitable, I think there needs to be a lot of adaptability and flexibility. So I guess more so framed around sort of possibilities and opportunities of what success has looked like. Did any conversation around that come up?
Yeah. I'm hesitating because sometimes I think it's okay to kind of push people to a new world, right? Like we can keep kind of on the same treadmill, or we can think outside the box. And so I'm going to go here. I'm always like, oh, I don't know if I should bring this up. But so I've done a lot of work in Singapore. And the reason I think it's a great model, like it's clearly far away, different government, you know, all these things, is they have some pretty tough laws on the books. They, you know, use all sorts of, they have some similarities, I would say, to the US system. But over the last two decades, they've really moved the needle on how individuals who are incarcerated, how they're treated. And so I feel so passionate about this. Like I went one time on a Fulbright, I went back because I'm like, do I believe what I saw? You know, I'm pretty critical. And Monica and I, along with our social work department, plan to bring a group of students and professionals back in January. Cause I think it's something you gotta see, right? Like here's a country, I know it's smaller, I know there's all these hesitations, but they've really started to change how you can do criminal justice and how you treat individuals who are system involved. And watching the community receive people back after they've been in prison was just super powerful. So I think next steps for me, besides continuing research, is really allowing people to see an example that's happening in the universe, right? Like this is happening. And I'm sure there's more countries than that country, but that's just the one I've come in contact with.
For sure. One of the things we talked about too is just, I mean, even starting small, right? Like with language, just simply yes. How we talk to each other, how you can talk to each, you know, to clients or individuals that you're working with in front of them. And then when they're not in the room, right? If we're going to really shift the mindset, that seemed to be one of the biggest discussions around next steps, was just continuing to try to shift mindset and little ways that we can do that. A lot of talk around like front loading, particularly like we think about in the juvenile justice system, getting this work like in schools, in community spaces. It seems like there's a lot of perception that this is really good for people in the front end of the juvenile justice system, like diversion, but it doesn't really have a space like once they're on probation or incarcerated or those kinds of things. And like to Anne's point, I mean, we know that this belongs anywhere and everywhere in community spaces, school, not even just in systems, like any kind of system, healthcare, like all kinds of places. So it's really just, it's broader than just a system initiative. It's really just a philosophy.
Yeah. And Monica, as you're speaking, not to be like too utilitarian about it, but I can imagine that like people having more understanding, more grounding in like the language and philosophy of restorative justice also impacts what they say during an evaluation, or like when you're collecting qualitative responses for research. I think you're right. You said earlier that like we are sort of embedded in an adversarial punitive system. I think that that's true. If you are, you know, in the United States, socialized within this context, I think that's true. So as people come into this understanding more, I do just imagine, and I'm sure you both see this every day, that as people come into a better understanding, that may shift what they say and how programs are evaluated.
Yeah, one of the things we started a juvenile justice certificate program and have a whole module about restorative work, this year adding a whole module about restorative justice. But I think one of the things we've talked about is just how do we find and make those opportunities for people to see it in action, right? Or to experience it. It's one thing to talk about it. I feel like we talk about it a lot, but how do you experience it? Because that makes such a big difference in your ability to really buy in and see how it can work.
And language is so important because I was thinking as you were both talking, we teach a class for our undergraduates where they're matched to a youth that's in a facility, right? So it could be a group home or a detention facility. And then they journal about it, and watching the language and encouraging language that's humanizing is so important. Even in just, you can really see it through language, what people kind of hold in their hearts. And so that's important, but then also it opens the door. We have quite a few students who've had a family member who's system involved or have had some experience themselves. And so opening that door for them to have a space to share their experiences, to reach out to younger kids that are going through it and say, hey, you know, I was there, now I'm a university student. So I think we can each find our own little corner of the world where we can start working on this. You know, it's not without obstacles though, because I have students who leave and then 2 years later they're working in the system and they'll come back critical and they'll say, the system doesn't look like what your class promised me. I say, I know, I'm telling you, you got to change the world, right? Like I tell you this in class, didn't you listen? So, you know, I think we just have to be kind of together, like having more sessions like this and more meetings like we had in San Francisco and in Vermont, right? It makes us realize there's lots of people working on changing this and making our system more humane. And we can reach out to one another when there's setbacks, because there's going to be, it's a big system that needs reform, right? So it's just comforting to talk to like-minded people, I think. So.
Absolutely. Agreed. And creating, you know, again, the goal of this conversation and creating this sort of next series from this is one step towards broadening the conversation to others who are interested and really deeply committed to this work. And knowing that it's a real challenge for being able to be in the same place in the same time. So for those who weren't able to do that, to keep that conversation going. So we have one last question for you both, the $1 million question that could change next week. It could change tomorrow, but for today, if you had a magic wand, what would a comprehensive approach to evaluating and implementing restorative justice in a way that promotes equitable system design, what would it look like?
And that should sound familiar because we borrowed it from you both.
Passing the magic wand your way, Anne.
Oh, goodness.
Monica, you want me to start? Or you
yeah, go start? For it. That's a loaded question. Who thought of that question? We thought of that question.
Wow, that was terrible. That had to come to me, Monica. Huge. You know, I think if tomorrow this is a magic wand, right? So if tomorrow we did not have a criminal justice system or a juvenile justice system, that would be my magic wand, because people, when you don't have an immediate solution, you get more inventive and more creative. And so even though, like in our rural areas in Nebraska, we find they have a lower rate of sending kids to detention. And the reason is they don't want to drive 8 hours across Nebraska or five, right? So they figure it out in their community. And so if I had a magic wand, I would eliminate all our juvenile detention centers and most or all of our adult systems, and we would figure this out in our communities.
Hmm.
Yeah, I know.
Ditto.
Okay, I just sounded like an abolitionist, but you know, I guess that's
where it sounds like you also need to kind of pair that with that Men in Black pen that like erases, like you need to also forget,
yes,
the, you know, to not go back and divert exactly to that. You need sort of the wand and that pen, I think, simultaneously. Yes.
right you can't,
oh my gosh, this. I like that.
Magic wand. I think that we wouldn't just be having this conversation around justice systems. We would be having this conversation in every system. You know, and it's something that we would start having discussions, like preschoolers would be learning how to use this language, right? From the time that, you know, from the very first type of whatever system anyone encounters, that there's restorative language. That's just the foundation of everything that we do.
Yeah. That's beautiful. And yeah, I think a beautiful note for us to sort of wrap up this conversation. But before we go, I just want to ask either of you or both of you if there's sort of parting words that you have, words of wisdom to maybe folks who are breaking into the restorative justice world, doing research and evaluation, working in community, working in programs, if there's anything that you would sort of leave listeners with. What is that?
I would say reach out to one another. So if you're a practitioner and you're struggling, you know, because the system doesn't work ideally the way we want it to, reach out to another practitioner. If you're a researcher, reach out to me, reach out to Monica. Like, I think there's real power when we come together and acknowledge the hurdles we have to climb over, but also just the how worthwhile this work is. So that would be my 2 cents to leave you with.
Yeah, same. I think I would just tag off Anne and say, like, don't give up, right? Because it's not going to work every single time, but we're definitely not alone. So I think the more we can come together in spaces, you know, like we did at the convening and in podcasts and informally and formally, let's continue to work together. So yeah, we'd love to hear from people too.
Beautiful. Yeah, you heard it, folks. We're going to put your information, if that's okay, for folks to reach out for emails and things. Alana, anything from you?
Just thank you both so much for sharing your time, for sharing your thoughts and your incredible work. I think this is really exciting and we really appreciate, really appreciate your time today. And thank you for kicking off our new season of the Restorative Lens.
Yes, thank you so much.
Thanks for inviting us. Thank you for creating this space. It's great.
Thank you. And thank you all for making research and evaluation so fun. Like, this was such a fun conversation.
That's all, Anne. I really do love research. It's goofy, but I do.
If research can sort of visually be, if those listening could see Anne's background right now, it's like just full of color and different directions and movement of things that don't need to make sense, but they look beautiful. So let's hope that research and evaluation can move in that direction too.
But they kind of have a pattern, right?
They do kind of have a pattern. Yeah, it's kind of representative.
I love that.
All right, thank you both so much. This project is supported by grants awarded by the Bureau of Justice Assistance. The Bureau of Justice Assistance is a component of the U.S. Department of Justice's Office of Justice Programs.
Points of view, images, or opinions in this podcast are those of the hosts and guests and do not necessarily represent the official position or policies of the U.S. Department of Justice.